You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back, Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and as always, I'm really pleased to welcome Alistair MacLeod to the show once again. Thanks for joining us, Alistair.
That's my pleasure, Jay.
And, it's really good to have you, and especially, always good to have you, but especially when markets are in turmoil like this, and your insights are always so welcome and so useful. I should tell people that every Thursday you put out an essay that's very apropos to whatever's going on in the markets, and you can go to goldmoney.com, and I guess I forget which sub page it is, but it's goldmoney.com, and what is it? It's specifically
hit research, and then insights.
Insights, that's it.
Yeah. Okay, there. Yeah.
Very good. Anyway, it's excellent, and it's one of those things I can't do without, I feel. It's so helpful. But I'd like to talk to you about your, I guess it was a February 24th article, How Ukraine Fits Into the Global Jigsaw, and then a little bit later ask you, with things not turning out the way any of us were expecting pretty much, how that alters your view of things. But your article, How Ukraine Fits Into the Global Jigsaw, it was written on the eve of the Russian invasion, I believe, or just about the time that they were starting to go into the Ukraine. Then I would, as I say, would like to ask you also, then the other article was when normality is exposed as a Ponzi. But in any event, in your February 24th article, you wrote, and I quote, Ukraine is part of a far bigger geopolitical picture. Russia and China want U.S. hegemonic influence in the Eurasian continent. They want U.S. hegemony marginalized in that part of the world. And following defeats for U.S. foreign policy in Syria and Afghanistan, and following Brexit, Putin is driving a wedge between America and the non-Anglo-Saxon EU. Also in that same article, you wrote, and I quote, being keenly aware that its dominant role in NATO is under threat, America has been trying to escalate the Ukraine crisis to suck Russia into an untenable occupation. Putin won't fall for it, end of quote. Well, obviously, your view and the view of most people was not correct. Putin has not only hit, I guess he's hit military installations, but not all that successfully. So he's taken on sort of a mass shelling of civilian areas, killing lots of people, and maiming a lot of them. Why do you think Putin has conducted such a bloody war as he has? And do you think that his targeting of civilians will prove to have been a big mistake?
Well, I think things sort of rather got out of control. I mean, normally he's got a very measured approach to geopolitical issues. And really, by sort of standing back and letting America make all the mistakes, so far, he's actually done very well. I say this not in admiration of him at all, because he is a ruthless leader, and has been successful by being ruthless. I mean, once America had messed up Syria, which was the bridge for Hezbollah to receive arms and support from Iran. Once that was all messed up, and the Americans and their, vested interests in Syria were beginning to lose out and on the run, then Russia came in and really blasted Aleppo. I mean, you see pictures of the streets in Aleppo after the bombing campaign. It was entirely ruthless. I think I think what's happened with Ukraine is that he made the mistake of thinking he could repeat that because the Americans are on the run. I mean, they pulled out of Afghanistan, and not only that, but there was apparently an attempted coup d'etat backed by the CIA in Azerbaijan. And, you know, they very, very quickly sent in the troops and sorted that one out. So, you know, it, as far as Putin is concerned, I think America is on the run. His real interest is, as you said earlier, to basically remove or diminish American interest in Western Europe. And there are two elements of this. There is the control through NATO that America exercises on military policy, if you like, for the Western Europe alliance. And also, the other thing he wanted was for NATO to move back from being so close to Russia. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these are perfectly understandable. But I think the hubris really sort of got a bit away with him. And this is where all us armchair commentators got it wrong. He then walked into, first of all, you know, the Donbass and around the sort of eastern end, recognizing them. And the next thing we know, his troops were mobilized. But we knew before this happened that it was a stupid thing to do, because the only way you could invade eastern Ukraine is in a sharp winter when the ground is frozen. Otherwise, your tanks just get bogged down. And that basically is what has happened, because he's been restricted to, you know, sort of main tarred roads. Any time they've sort of gone off, as it were, the whole thing has just sort of fallen apart. And of course, he's had to contend with what is, in essence, is a guerrilla war. So it's the first really big geopolitical mistake that Putin has made. And I think we should note that we have now put him into a corner. And when you put a bear into a corner, watch out.
Yeah, that's scary. And of course, they did mention that they were, you know, getting ready with their nuclear weapons if we do anything untoward from their point of view. A lot has been made, Alistair, at least in our propaganda campaign here, that NATO has been united like never before. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, that's right. I mean, this is one of the losses that Putin has inflicted upon himself. Before then, NATO was very much divided, you know, with the Europeans quite happy to let the Americans take the lead and spend all the money. And, you know, they sit back and say, well, you know, we can't do this, we can't do that. But by invading the Ukraine and creating a refugee crisis with, and I'm sorry to put it like this, but, you know, white people like us in Western Europe on the receiving end of this, you know, it has had the effect of completely uniting NATO. And, you know, so big, big mistake. But as I say, you know, the reason I would be worried about this is that the real war always has been a financial war, and to that we can now add a commodity war. And there are so many illusions about Russia in the West. I mean, one is that the economy is weak. It's not weak, actually. Yes. You know, they don't depend on imports from the West, so cutting them off, all that achieves is it puts up exchange controls instead of the Central Bank of Russia having to do it. It won't be very long before the ruble steadies. But there are aspects of this which I think are blowing back badly. The commodity side, I mean, particularly when it comes to energy, I would not be surprised to see Putin now really begin to turn the screws on natural gas supplies and oil supplies into Western Europe. So we're going to see prices, I think, continue, energy prices continue to rise. And of course, with all the money printing that's been going on in recent years, and undoubtedly the response from Western nations that they will continue to print money to pay for higher prices. These prices are just going to go up and up and up.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine, you know, we're talking about tightening here, 25 basis points, and supposedly that's the Fed is going to go through with that this month sometime. And but, you know, we're already having a weakening economy here, and it's just hard to see how far they can take that. I mean, is there any way the Fed can go, but when things really start breaking down, and they could break down any time, I would think, and I know that you keep track of the situation. The European banks, you know, are in some difficulty, perhaps, if I read you right. It's just hard to see how they won't open the money spigots again and just blast, you know, trillions more dollars into the system, right? Can't you pretty much count on that?
Yeah, you're right. It is pretty much inevitable. When it comes to interest rates, I mean, there was a general consensus that the next hike would actually be 50 basis points, and that's been rowed back to expectations 25. Of 25 basis points. So we have this situation where, in a sense, I think there is relief at the Fed that, you know, there are signs that the economy actually is slowing. So they feel that they won't need to push up interest rates. But this is just completely wrong, because they don't understand what interest rates are. Interest rates mm-hmm. are not the price of money, which is what the Keynesians think.
Yes,
interest
yes.
rates reflect the depreciation, the expected depreciation of the purchasing power of the currency. And I mean, quite simply, and I know we've discussed this on your show yeah. before, with inflation running at over 7% on the CPI, and with independent analysts saying it's probably double that, and I'm referring to John Williams at Shadow Stats, who I know you have on your show sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There is no doubt about it. We have got record negative yields. Mm-hmm. This cannot continue for long. The Fed can do what it likes, trying to sort of say, well, you know, we're not going to raise interest rates because the outlook is dismal. But the fact of the matter is that markets will do it for them. And that is the big danger that we face. The basis of valuation for bonds, and as a consequence of that, the valuation basis for equities, that is going to start turning very negative. And we've begun to see an erosion of the bull market. I mean, you could argue that it is already over, but you know, it's the interest rate outlook. The markets will take control of interest rates. They will go considerably higher, and there is nothing the Fed or the Bank of England or the ECB or the Bank of Japan can do about it.
Yeah, and as you point out, that is having an impact on the balance sheets of a lot of different central banks, and that the central banks themselves may be becoming insolvent.
I mean, the problem the central banks have is that in the bad old days before quantitative easing, if I put it that way, their balance sheets were relatively clean. But now, of course, they've turned into huge, great investment trusts holding predominantly bonds. The Bank of Japan mm-hmm. has also got equities, and so has the Swiss National Bank. But so when you get rising yields, guess what? The prices go down, and mm-hmm. Central banks suddenly are in negative equity. In other words, their liabilities exceed their assets. So they need refinancing. And, you know, how embarrassing is that?
Well, all they can do then, since the only thing they know to do is to create more money out of thin air, more units of currency or whatever, right?
Well, except the problem there is that as they do that, they
more debt.
The currencies even more. I mean, they've really got themselves into an enormous stew over this. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually writing the next article, which will be published on Thursday. Mm-hmm. I explain how they will try and resolve this. But the big difference, I mean, these things have happened before. The Bank of England has got itself into difficulties back in 1697. And that was resolved by basically a recapitalization provided by the Treasury and financed out of credit, believe it or not. They can do the same again. But the difference is that back then we had what was called specie. In other words, we were on a silver standard. And the problem that the bank had was it had a run. Its notes were being cashed in for silver. The silver standard continued. The bank was recapitalized to manage it. We now have a situation where there is pure fiat currency. So goodness knows what happens when these banks recapitalize themselves.
You make a point that these sanctions are really not going to do much longer term. As you say, Russia doesn't import that much from us. We depend tremendously on oil and energy. Europe does especially. You point that Russia can turn to China, and they are. And I think already with these restrictions that are being placed on sanctions and so forth, that they have already some arrangement for credit cards from the Chinese, if I'm not wrong. This is going to draw China and Russia closer together. I think there's no doubt about that, is there? And how can those two countries work together? Because they have been working increasingly together. I think you point out in your article that China can buy Russia's oil, although they don't have the capacity to send as much to China as they can to Europe, right?
Yeah.
Talk to us a little bit about how Russia and China can work together. And then I'd like you also to talk a little bit about Russia's economy and how, most Americans, as you said, we think that Russia's weak. But actually, if you look at their balance sheet of their central bank compared to our 130% of debt to GDP, they're something like 20%, I think you pointed out.
Yeah.
They have a 13% flat tax. My goodness, would I love to have a 13% flat tax.
Exactly.
They have limited regulations, you say. Right?
Yep. It's lightly regulated, flat tax of 13%, and government debt to GDP of only 20%. I mean, this is a libertarian's dream, actually.
Yeah.
The problem, I think, is that it's not really recorded properly when you look at things like GDP and so on. And if you look at GDP, I mean, that basically is a reflection of the amount of fiat currency being pushed into the economy.
Right.
So, commentators who don't understand this think that, the figures coming out of Russia reflect a stagnant economy. It doesn't at all, because, the money's, put it this way, the money is being used better there than it is in the Western equivalents.
Mm-hmm.
The Chinese relationship, if I can just go back to that a little bit,
mm-hmm.
I think this was best summed up by the official news agent, which is obviously a government feed. They stated that they're not allies of Russia, which basically means that they won't support Russia in the, let's say, in the United Nations resolutions and things like that. They will just abstain. But they are partners of Russia, which basically means that they will work together with Russia when it comes to commercial interests,
mm-hmm.
when it comes to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, when it comes to things like interbank messaging, the sort of the equivalent of SWIFT. All these things, China will work with Russia. And importantly, China will work with Russia with respect to gold. So, I really think that it's virtually impossible for the West to run a tight ship in terms of sanctions, because, China is an enormous economy through which these things can leak.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to oil, I mean, it's quite simple. It will take time to get the volumes diverted from places like Europe round to China, because they don't have the pipe network that they have mm-hmm. going into Western Europe. And not only that, but if it goes round by sea, it's got to go all the way around the Cape of Good Hope, because they won't let Russian tankers through. So so we're talking about a trip of about 35 days, I guess, from the Baltic getting round there. So there is a delay on this, but do Russia care? I mean, what's happened is that they don't really need to sell the oil, because they've got a fundamentally sound economy, and the oil that they do sell is just getting a higher and higher price, and it's in their interest to push the prices up as much as possible. They've now got control over energy prices, being the largest exporter of energy in the world, and also they've got control over various key commodities. I mean, we saw, for example, the price of nickel spiking up hugely on a short squeeze. And palladium was another one. I mean, that just absolutely rocketed up the other day. And so this is something, I think it could well affect silver. I think silver more than gold, actually. Mm-hmm. And this is going to be a very, very interesting time for a number of commodities where there isn't much stock around. I mean, and metals have been in backwardation for months, which basically means that there is a shortage for immediate delivery.
Right.
What a time for the West to turn around and tell Russia, we don't want any of your commodities, so, you know, go away. I mean, for goodness sake,
take a hike.
The stupid thing we could do? But anyway, yeah. That's politics.
Well, I think, it's politics. It's what, you know, what gets them voted, what gets them votes, I guess, but you talked a little bit about how this could sort of lead to a ruble backed by gold. Could you just talk about that a little bit with about 3 minutes left?
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is a little bit sort of jumping the gun a bit, but
sure.
Just note that because we have turned around and said to Russia, right, you know, your currency reserves are worthless, with the exception of the drop, obviously, their holdings in Chinese yuan, but they've got a lot of euros in particular. They've got less dollars. So, the Russian central bank is sitting there on something like $500 million equivalent of foreign currency, which is absolutely useless. What's the message from that? The message from that is don't hold foreign currencies. If you're going to have anything in your reserves, make it gold. And I think that the easiest way for the Russian central bank to stabilize its currency, if it needs to do so, is actually add to its gold position and somehow get perhaps into the market a view that the ruble is backed by gold. They may have to do that. I mean, if I was doing it, what I would do is I would ramp up the price of gold in Western markets through China and other Asian markets, and I would get it to a level where I would want to fix the ruble to it and have a coin exchange facility, if you like, so that individuals could submit their rubles to the central bank in return for gold coin. That is, you know, probably something that will be a little bit down the road, but the more we get the feeling that this sort of thing is likely to happen, the more it's going to erode confidence in fiat currencies, which have no backing whatsoever. And guess what? The American Fed and the US Treasury in particular have spent the last 50 years from when Nixon took the dollar off the last tiny vestige, the fig leaf of a gold standard. They've been damning gold and saying it's not money. The dollar is, and consequently, nobody is prepared emotionally, mentally, or any understanding of what true money is.
Right.
They're not prepared for this at all. So the effect, I think, actually could be really quite catastrophic for the West.
Well, we've seen. Gold was up some $72 around lunchtime, 12 o'clock today, noon. It got taken down quite a bit, but it's still up. I don't know. I haven't seen it since we started went on the show, but $30, $40 or so. Do you think these current events are having anything to do with that?
Indeed. I mean, absolutely. It's currently trading at 2052. So uh-huh. This is, so it's on the way back up. And I don't think there's any stock in the market. I mean, there really isn't. And I think that's particularly the case of silver. I mean, if you look at the way silver has performed, it really feels like a real squeeze on the establishment. And I think I would hesitate to say that we could have another sort of nickel spike on silver, but it's got the makings of, you know, the same sort of dynamics behind driving the price. There is no silver available, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it is used in industry too, and by the green for the green deals. You know, the people that want to go green, they need silver and copper and all these metals. And anyway, we'll have to leave it go at that, Alistair. We are out of time. I want to thank you so much for your insights. Always so valuable. And we'll just hang on to your gold. I guess that's the message. And
I think so.
Yeah, those anyway. Of us who
Thanks very much for having me on.
You're welcome. Thanks for being with us. All right, folks, that is it for this week. Next week, Kevin Duffy of the Coffee Can Portfolio Newsletter will be with me, and Michael Oliver, as well as Quentin Henning, will join me to talk about an update on the evolving world-class silver tin deposit in Bolivia. that is owned by El Oro, one of the sponsors of this show. Should be a great show, so I hope you'll join me. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.